We have a hell of a program. And we have a hell of a program because we have worked on it, massaged it, tuned it up, and because we are experts in adult learning theory. We understand what the problem is we're dealing with. We figured out a way to do it quickly, to give people the skills they need in a behavioral sense. So people go back to work and they feel good about how they were treated, and their bosses or other people see them as being better. And they say, wow, this looks like a pretty good program. We should send more people to the program.
So yesterday I was with an employee of mine who's a director level person, and he is considered a very high potential within our company. And he actually doesn't know I'm on the board. I was going through his development plan with him yesterday, and we were discussing where were the gaps, what has he accomplished this year, what's next. And just he had offered, I had asked, which of these programs do you feel like you actually got something from? And he said, well, there's one on this list that's been pretty life-changing. And I said, well, which one is that? And he said, it's the power speaking course. I said, really interesting. Why is that? And his point was that what he learned in the power speaking program, and it was actually high-tech speaking to the big dogs program, he had said it permeates all the other dimensions to his life. And because he had more tools from this course, he was feeling more confident and more successful in all these other dimensions. And I walked away from that meeting thinking money well spent, high return on investment. So it was very exciting to be a part of an organization and get that kind of testimonial from a person.
People that we have sent here have come back almost like zealots. They tend to proselytize. They tend to, you know, try and show off their newfound skills like it's a new laser saber that they picked up with a Jedi Knight.
Yeah, it is.
But it makes them more efficient. It makes them better presenters. And my mantra in our organization is: if we can cut the meeting down by 5 minutes, we've probably saved a couple thousand dollars. So getting people to be more concise, better presenters, has an immediate payback for us.
We started on a lie with stolen material. How's that? So sue me. I attended an ASTD meeting one night, American Society for Training and Development. Sat next to a guy at the table. What he did was coordinate programs at De Anza College in business. And he was telling me this story. And he said, I used to have a program for executives, and I called it Management Skills. And I would get 8 or 10 people would show up. I wanted to get more people to show up, so I called it Management Power, or Power for Managers, or Empowering the Manager. I put the word power in it. And suddenly I had 30 people show up. I'm thinking about that. Think, you know what? That would be a good name for a class, wouldn't it? Power Speaking. So from the very beginning, and this was way before we started the company. So the company started in 85. This must have been, you know, 1982, 80, somewhere in there. Well, once we got started, we wanted to trademark the name. And of course, it's a great name, and so other people like it too. And we actually had to fight with some people to show that we had first use of it. In a junior college catalog, I called it Power Speaking. That was prior to anybody else calling it that. We were able to get the thing trademarked. And even now, as you see the word Power Speaking, referring to the course, not the company, you'll see an R with a circle around it. That's a registered trademark. It's a big deal to get that. From then, we went ahead and trademarked everything else, including high-tech speaking and including our logo with the little man with the microphone. It's all been registered trademarked. That's how that got started. Then it was a question of finding anybody who wanted to buy this new product that I had developed. And I am embarrassed to tell you that I used some of the materials from Amdahl in the first workbook, including this guy's really clever cartoons. I liberated some of those materials and began doing these presentations with this until we had our own materials. And then we still have one of those workbooks around.
I remember being at Sea Ranch, and we were kind of looking at materials and looking at a model. And somehow Rick had an advertisement from a dry cleaner. And there was a triangle that said quality,
speed,
cost.
And speed.
pick two was the kind of the concept. And Rick said, you know, we could have this model, this triangle, and we can have content, we can have, you know, the style of it.
Let's call it
environment. And so
substance, style, and staging.
So we got the alliteration going. But the triangle idea was from a dry cleaning
ad. Well, speaking of ripping off, of course, I, as a psychologist, I had studied Abe Maslow. One day we're looking at how do we conceptualize the style components. I know. How about a style hierarchy? Just like the hierarchy of needs. So we developed that. But that's not enough. We're looking, for the first couple of years, we didn't have a lot of very strong material when it came to content. We said, you know, have an opening, have a body, have a close, and mostly we were coaching people on style. You know, wave your arms and look at people and be, you know, charismatic. Bill Moyers was doing a whole series of programs on a guy called Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell was a mythologist who was professor for many years at Smith College, and he'd written books about myth forms and myth structures throughout human history, all cultures. And he wrote a particular book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And a piece of that was what he called The Hero's Journey. Now, this applies to all stories that human beings relate to from the beginning of human history. Wizard of Oz is a perfect example of that. You have ordinary life, tornado comes, Dorothy goes on a big journey where she learns about herself. There's no place like home. Oh, Auntie Em. She comes back to Kansas with this new revelation. Well, that's a story that you see in Star Wars. Every great drama, saga, book, movie, whatever, has that story if it's engaging to us. So I'm looking at this oval, and I'm thinking, it's kind of like a speaker's journey, right? I mean, you have an introduction, you have a body where all the action happens, and then you have a conclusion. So we started drawing little boxes around Joseph Campbell's circle. Pretty soon we had, this is your intro, and then we had a couple of key points, and by then we'd sort of dumped in the idea of a core message, and I think Melinda was the one who came up with that idea, the core message. And it evolved, and right from the beginning, people liked that model, and it worked. And I began to realize that the reason it worked is it's mythological. It's been around throughout human history, and there's something about it that just connects with people at a deep level. So I guess you can say a lot of our models have been borrowed from dry cleaners or from from Abe Maslow or from Joseph Campbell.
Or trainers. Trainers Day.
Yeah.
How much do your trainers contribute to your thinking about your coursework?
Huge. Absolutely huge.
We couldn't be the company that we are today without the intelligence and insight of the trainers.
From Melinda talking about the core message early on to just a few months ago, Dan Farley introducing the concept of a slide burst. It's just rich. Robert Fish wrote that wonderful article called The Bozo Zone. So, I mean, it's a rich stew of ideas and suggestions that we get from people. In fact, we had lunch one time with one of our competitors' trainers. This was years ago. And we said to this person, how do you make changes in your program? And she looked at us with this blank stare. Changes? You don't. You couldn't change the program. It's been this way for years, and this is the way we're going to do it forever. You don't change the program. I thought, wow, is that different from what we do? You look in our workbooks, and you'll notice that it's, you know, edition 22 or something like that. I mean, we're always introducing new ideas and keeping it fresh.
We had power speaking for 6 years before anything else happened. And we kept working with everyone and saying one size fits all, essentially. And the fact is we would miss on the engineers.
What was different about the engineers?
The engineers were finding it frustrating to have so many political video examples. They were much more skeptical about the the training process in the beginning. They had different kinds of audiences that they were speaking to. Their vocabulary was so different. So they would come in and want to do a data dump, and you know, we just say, no, you can't do it that way, and here's how you do it. But it was apparent that we weren't hitting the mark with the engineers. And it was at that point, in about 1991, that we brought somebody in. We had interviews with 26 different technical managers, and we just said very specifically, what's different? What do your engineers need? What do your scientists need? And then we changed the whole presentation, the process with iTech speaking.
I think that the technical people are skeptical of too much rah-rah. They're data-focused, and many of the people who are in our industry are the English majors of the world, let's face it. People who are engineering in background rarely go into our field. So we find that a lot of people in speech communication are training salespeople, and the engineers are very skeptical of that. When we launched this program, High Tech Speaking, we changed the workbook, we changed the look and feel of it. We still had the practice, we still had video, we still talked about style, but we had a different shift. And instead of, as Mary said, instead of using video examples that were politicians, we began to use video examples that were Nobel Prize winners. And you could begin to see the resistance melt on their faces as they said, oh, well, you know, if Seymour Cray, the inventor of the supercomputer, can do it, huh, maybe I can do it. And it was just a marvelous breakthrough. Now, also, some other things were moving along in our own thinking. And as I mentioned before, we had not much to offer in the way of content, and we were very big on a lot of rah-rah and style. But as our thinking evolved, and especially high tech and working in Silicon Valley, I began to realize that what really does matter is the content, that the content is towering, the content is critical, and that you only need style in order to make sure that the audience can track what you're saying. In other words, if you're mumbling and looking at your shoes, you can have great content, but they won't get it. So we say to people, not only technical people, but anybody that takes our program, it's about your message. And many of you have advanced degrees in what you're talking about. That's the hard part. Let's help you structure that so that it's clear to your audience what you're trying to say. There's a clear message, a clear takeaway. And then, oh, by the way, if you look at people, they get it better. If you use stronger gestures, they believe you're confident in what you're saying. So there was a shift in that. And I think it made our program stronger because I think it took us out of that arena of rah-rah motivational salespeople things that the engineers hate and, frankly, I don't have any respect for either. And it put us much more grounded in the content.
Since all of you have taken a power speaking course, what are some of your favorite aspects of their work?
What's your core message?
And first line, bottom line.
There's a number of phrases that, you know, let her rip, and that becomes embedded in the group that I work with. First line, bottom line, or, you know, just it becomes something that you don't think of, that you act. And so I think that's the best part of the training.
I love the idea that we have a company that's based on something solid, and that we spend a lot of time looking at research, that we change things. We're always questioning, trying to come up with new ideas. An example of that is this whole thing, and you've probably heard this before, your content is only worth 7% of your message. You've probably heard that.
The Morabian. Well,
that came from a study by a guy called Albert Morabian, who was a social psychologist and wrote a book called Silent Messages. Well, somebody in our industry picked that up, and pretty soon everybody is saying, your message is only worth 7% of your overall impact. What else is there? Well, your visuals are 55% and your vocal quality is 38%, but your words are only worth 7%. Now think about that for a second. On the face of it, that's stupid. Especially if you're a technical person, especially if you're a Nobel Prize winner or something. You can look at the floor and mumble and people will be at your feet listening to what you say. Well, what happened, I was doing a program for a large group and I quoted that study. This was very early on. This guy came up to me afterwards and he said, excuse me, I was a graduate student with Albert Morabian and everything you just said is total nonsense. And Morabian was afraid that people would misuse his study. It had nothing at all to do with speech communication or public speaking. It was only interpersonal. I thought, well, that's interesting. So I wrote an article for our newsletter on this called Oh Yeah? Says Who? And what we did was we tried to summarize all of the data and research that we were aware of up to that point. And in preparation of that article, I called Albert Morabian. I introduced myself. I'm this speech guy up in Redwood City, da-da-da. We read this thing. What do you think about it? And Albert Morabian told me, he said, it's nonsense. It had nothing to do with speech. He just confirmed what the graduate student said. It had nothing to do with speech communication. And furthermore, nobody's ever been able to duplicate those results. And then he said, furthermore, I'm not a professor anymore. I sell real estate. So I just love it. Every time I hear somebody say, your message is only worth 70, say, come on, what silly nonsense. So we have, not only do I take a lot of pride in the fact that we try to base what we're talking about and recommending to people, we try to base it on something substantial, some research, some studies that have been done. But also, when you hear somebody who quotes a statistic like that, I would encourage you just to say, oh yeah, really? How do you know for sure? Who said that?
You've said all along that stop-action coaching, the one-on-one coaching, and the videotaping is part of what really changes people's behavior. How did that come into, when did that become a part of the coursework, or was it there from the beginning?
When I was in Toastmasters, it was very frustrating to me. And I was in this particular club I belonged to for 10 years. I would watch somebody get up week after week and do exactly the same thing wrong. Let's say eye contact. Or nervous gestures, whatever it happened to be. And then you'd write down your little notes to the person, say, you know, Bob, why don't you look at us when you talk? I was sitting there thinking, why doesn't somebody just yell at this guy? Yeah, Bob, look at us when you talk. You know, try it out. Bob, use bigger gestures. Of course, nobody would do that. It wasn't the culture of Toastmasters. So pretty early on in the development of our classes, we tried to introduce this. And at first, it's rough, because if you do it badly, it can be insulting or embarrassing to the person. So you have to kind of figure out how to do this effectively. But to my mind, it is very powerful because the person doesn't know what they're doing. They're unconscious when they're up there in front of the room. And sometimes I'll go up and actually move their arm and actually sculpt them and say, now put your arm, no, not in front, not right, no, don't hold it tight here in front. Move it out to the side and make a strong gesture. And oh, but that's embarrassing. It's phony. It's just acting. That's true. Do it anyway. And then they see it on video and they say, wow, what a difference. But if you didn't have the ability to do that stopping in the moment, they'd never get it. And then they go for coaching.
Coaching was fundamental to the whole process from the beginning. We knew that we wanted to have a two-trainer model rather than a one-trainer model. We felt as though if we did videotaping and then played it back within the room, there were two problems immediately. One problem was how critical, how insightful can you be in front of a group when this person is vulnerable, when this person is in front of the peers? So we knew that we wanted to have privacy. The second issue about knowing that we wanted to have a two-trainer rather than a one-trainer model was we felt like the waste of time was going to be too enormous. That, okay, everybody does 12 talks, and then we watch 12 talks. It's a waste of time. And when you can go privately into a room and see together what that person is doing, how that person is standing up, responding, you know, it just works out a lot better. So coaching was instrumental. You are going to work on skills, on behaviors, on an ability to put a talk together, an ability to stand up on your solid feet, your ability to use some space. You're going to work on all that. At the same time, when you are going in there as a coach with this feeling of appreciation of the person, then something magical happens because you have the combination of head and intellect and heart and care. And when that mixes, you create some magic and the person develops. And it's not because we've gone into the psychological aspect of fear or the psychological aspect of anger. It's that they've learned how to do some things and they've learned something about themselves along the way. And so they're different as they walk out. I can sit in that room and in the last presentation, I cry, or I'll have this physical reaction where I get goosebumps, and I'll look over and I'll put the person's hand and say, look at that. That's what you've done. That's what you've done for your audience. You have created an energy in that room. You've made a difference. And so I can physically respond to the moment.
We were working with Hewlett-Packard a number of years ago. There was a woman in the program who was having a hard time. And one of the things that we do, as you know, is called stop-action coaching. Well, this woman was not doing well. I had stopped her a number of times, and I went too far. I began to see her bottom lip start to quiver. I thought, oh, shit, I've done it. I've blown it. She stops, walks over, grabs her purse and her stuff, and walks out the door and slams the door. I tried to catch her. It didn't work. I thought, oh, that's just awful. It gives a bad message to everybody in the room, and plus we've made somebody's life a lot more painful than it needed to be, and I felt horrible about it. I was able to find out who she was, her phone number, and so forth. I called her up, and I interviewed her a little bit on the phone, and I said, I'm terribly sorry about what happened. I want to make it up to you. If you will do it, we'd like to offer you a free spot in our open workshop to see if you can get back on the horse. She came to the free workshop, and once again, a lot of this stuff started up, but I handled it differently this time. She was in the front of the room. She was all quaky and shaky, and I went up and stood next to her, and I touched her for a minute, and I said, you know, just talk to me. Never mind these people. Just talk to me. And I got her to talk to me, and then I backed away, and she was talking louder, and pretty soon she got over it, and she was fine. I heard later that she went on to be president of her professional organization and speak a lot. It was a success story.
It all starts with self-confidence, and that's what PowerSpeak brings to the individuals. As their self-confidence goes up, their credibility with themselves as well as with others goes up, and they're more successful in achieving what they're wanting, negotiations or expressing opinions.
I worked with a woman who obviously was tentative. She had a difficult time presenting. She was very bright in her writing, in her ability to put the talk together. I just couldn't tap into what was going on with her when she stood up. You know, so we tried to do it seated, and she seemed to do fine, but it was when she stood up. And it was only in the very last session, when she did that final presentation, and she moved from one spot to another, and she was looking at people in their eyes. It was in that final session, she said, I had a mastectomy 3 months ago. I have not been able to stand up. I have not been able to look at my own body image. I just can't. I just started just collapsing. And she said, it was this video process that I kept going up and you kept reinforcing me. And now I see, no one can tell. It doesn't matter. I'm the same person. I'm the same bright individual. My body is different. My mind's the same. And I have the same capability.
You get oftentimes a young female engineer, slightly built, timid, good with math, probably has a master's degree in computer science or something, but has never had the courage to speak up, never had the need to. But now she's in a job, she's maybe 25, and she's in a job where it's required. And we have been able to put together a program that is so powerful that in 2 days, we can take that person from zero to having a Superman costume on.